The following is a ministry of City Life Church in St. Paul, Minnesota. We hope you find this teaching encouraging and instructive. Perhaps you are currently a follower of Christ or are perplexed, skeptical, or even antagonistic to Christianity. Regardless, we would love to hear from you. Please contact us at info@citylifetc.org. Thank you for listening, and please contact us if we can be of service to you. Peace be with you.
And when the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and put him back in his place. But when they rose early on the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the ark of the Lord. And the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. This is why the priests of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon do not tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. The hand of the Lord was heavy against the people of Ashdod, and he terrified and afflicted them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. And when the men of Ashdod saw how things were, they said, the ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is hard against us and against Dagon our God. So they sent and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, what shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel? They answered, let the ark of the God of Israel be brought around to Gath. So they brought the ark of God of Israel there. But after they had brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against the city, causing a very great panic. And he afflicted the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. So they sent the ark of the God to Ekron. But as soon as the ark of God came to Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out, they have brought around to us the ark of God of Israel to kill us and our people. They sent therefore and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, send away the ark of God of Israel and let it return to its own place, that it may not kill us and our people. For there was a deathly panic throughout the whole city. The hand of God was very heavy there. The men who did not die were struck with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. The grass withers and the flowers fade.
Amen. Please be seated. Thank you, Jonathan. So in his two movies, The Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima, director Clint Eastwood tells the story of one pivotal battle from World War II from the perspective first of the Americans and then from the perspective of the Japanese. And in doing so, he emphasizes, of course, the common humanity of those who fought on both sides of that battle, as well as some of the moral ambiguities of war. Now, in 1 Samuel, the biblical narrator does something very similar. He tells the story of the Battle of Aphek, first from the perspective of the Israelites, which we looked at several weeks ago now in 1 Samuel chapter 4, and then from the perspective of the Philistines. He tells the story of that battle and its consequences, which we are looking at today in 1 Samuel chapter 5. And in doing so, the biblical author also, in a way, emphasizes the common fallen humanity of both the Israelites and the Philistines. But his real purpose is to emphasize that the Lord alone is God. He alone has power and glory. Without the help of the Israelites or without hindrance from the Philistines, the Lord does whatever he pleases. And all of the so-called gods of human imagining before him are powerless. Powerless to save, powerless to bless, powerless to give the good and abundant life that they promise. And so let's look first of all at what this passage has to say about the Lord in the house or in the temple of Dagon. And that's what we read about in the first five verses of 1 Samuel chapter 5. And in order to make sense of this passage, it's really helpful to understand just a little bit about religion and warfare in the ancient Near Eastern world. So for the nations surrounding Israel, when they would go to war, it was very common for the armies to take images of their gods into battle with them. And the thinking at that time was that the outcome of the battle was every bit as much dependent upon the gods who are fighting in heaven as it is upon the human armies that are fighting on the earth. And so you understand that the Israelites, having been defeated at the Battle of Aphek, the Philistines would quite naturally be assuming that their god Dagon had defeated the God of Israel, Yahweh, or the Lord. And when the Philistines capture the Ark of the Covenant, as we saw in chapter 4, when they capture that Ark of the Covenant, which they would have undoubtedly thought of as an admittedly strange image of Israel's God, they take the Ark of the Covenant, and as was the custom at that time, they place it in the temple of their God as a kind of trophy of war, as a way of reminding themselves and celebrating perpetually the great victory of Dagon over Yahweh, over the Lord, and the great victory of the Philistines over the Israelites. And so with all of that in mind, you can imagine how surprised and concerned the temple priests of the Philistines must have been the following morning when they discovered that the giant image of their god Dagon had fallen face down in front of the Ark of the Covenant. Now, this is truly an awkward situation if you're a priest in the land of the Philistines, right? Because symbolically, this looks an awful lot like your God is bowing down before the Lord, before the God of Israel, and acknowledging his greater power and glory. But we know, as a matter of fact, that earthquakes were very common in that part of the world, and so I imagine the priests of Philistia may have reasoned, well, there probably was a tremor of some sort in the night, and the image of our God being so much taller, it's understandable that it might have fallen over. And so they, as you can imagine, quickly, and I assume pretty quietly, gather some people together, and they carefully pick their God up off of his face, and they put him back up in place where he belongs. And yes, the biblical narrator most definitely intends for that to sound every bit as ridiculous and humiliating as it does. What sort of God has to be picked up off the ground by his people and put back in place? Well, as concerning as all of that must have been for the priests of Philistia, what happened the next morning was even worse, much worse. Because on the following morning, they discover that the image of their god Dagon has not only fallen face down again before the Ark of the Covenant, but Dagon's head and his hands have been cut off. Now again, in the ancient Near Eastern world, when a great king was conquered in battle, it was customary that he would often be beheaded. In fact, we get a little dose of that just a few chapters later in a famous story that we call David and Goliath. I'm sure the children will remember and maybe delight in the fact that after David kills the giant, you remember, he cuts off his head. And in the same way, when a king was defeated in battle in the ancient Near Eastern world, it was not uncommon for him to be beheaded. But sometimes the king's life might be spared and only his hands would be removed, because in the ancient world, the hand was commonly understood to be a symbol of power. The hand was a symbol of the king's ability to rule. It was a symbol of the king's ability to do his will. And so now, you see, the symbolism of what's going on in the temple of Dagon is painfully and inescapably clear. Dagon has not merely fallen down in worship before the greater glory and power of the Lord. Dagon has been utterly defeated by him. He has been rendered powerless by the Lord, the God of Israel. And of course, the point of this part of the story for the original readers and for us is simply to make it absolutely clear that the fact that the Israelites were defeated in battle, that the reason for that lies in their own rejection of the Lord and His ways, and has nothing whatsoever to do with any power that this supposed God Dagon might have over the Lord. Well, that brings us then to the Lord in the land of the Philistines, which is what we read about in the rest of the chapter in verses 6 through 12. And I just want you to notice that the key word in this section of the chapter is actually the word hand. Do you see that? In verse 6 it says, "The hand of the Lord was heavy against the people of Ashdod, and he terrified and afflicted them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory." And then in verse 7 it says, "When the men of Ashdod saw how things were, they said, 'The ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is hard against us and against Dagon, our God.'" And so they take the ark and they send it off to another Philistine city, to Gath. And then we read in verse 9, "But after they had brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against the city, causing a great panic, and he afflicted the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them." And so then they send the ark off to another city, to Ekron, right? And then we read in verse 11 that the people in Ekron said to the leaders, "Send away the ark of the God of Israel. Let it return to its own place, that it may not kill us and our people." For there was a deathly panic throughout the whole city. The hand of God was very heavy there. So do you see the point the author of this story is making? Dagon's hands have been cut off. He is powerless. Powerless to save his own people. Powerless to bless them. Powerless to give them the good and abundant life that he promises. But the hand of the Lord is heavy against the Philistines. The Lord has power to do whatever he pleases. And that power of the Lord is made very clear in a sobering way in this passage. It's actually made clear for the Philistines and for us as readers in two specific ways. First of all, we read that the Lord afflicted the Philistines with tumors. And so we see that in verse 6. Says that he afflicted and terrified the people of Ashdod with tumors. Then we see it again in verse 9, when for the people of Gath, it says the Lord caused a very great panic and afflicted them with tumors. And then again in verse 12, we read that in Ekron, there was a panic throughout the city because the hand of God was heavy there. The men who did not die were struck with tumors. Now, in chapter 6, the next chapter, in verses 4 and 5, we learn that the Lord not only afflicted the people with tumors, but that at the same time he afflicted the land of the Philistines with mice, a plague of mice that were devouring all the grain from their harvest. And so it seems likely that from a medical perspective, the plague that the Philistines were suffering was some form of bubonic plague. Because as you know, the bubonic plague spreads by rodents, and it causes skin lesions or tumors on those who are afflicted with the disease. But as interesting as that is from a historical and maybe a medical perspective, the thing that the author of our text is much more concerned with is the fact that, you see, Dagon was specifically a god of the harvest. He was specifically known as a grain god. Grain in the harvest is supposed to be his wheelhouse, right? And yet we see that even in this area, Dagon is powerless to save his people from these mice who are ravishing the land and from the disease that the mice are bringing upon them. In fact, if this all sounds familiar to you, it's probably because this whole story is very reminiscent of the plagues that the Lord sent upon the Egyptians during the time of the Exodus. The Egyptians had a whole pantheon of gods and goddesses which they believed controlled the Nile River and their livestock and the harvest and the sun and life and death. And the plagues that God sends upon the Egyptians are targeted specifically at those very things in order to make the point that the gods of Egypt have no power over these things, that the Lord alone is God, and as the Creator, He has power over every aspect of His creation, you see. And so this is the first way in which the Lord makes perfectly clear to the Philistines and to us that He has power and Dagon does not, is through this plague of mice and tumors that come upon the Philistines. And then the second way in which that is made perfectly clear in this part of our chapter is what we might call the ironic victory tour of the Lord. So once again, in the ancient Near Eastern world, when a king and his armies conquered a nation, it was customary for the king to then go on a victory tour of the major cities in the conquered nation. And so the king would go from city to city displaying his great power and glory and demanding that the conquered people give their allegiance to him now, you see. And again, what's ironic here is that the Israelites lost the Battle of Aphek, right? And yet it's the Lord who is going on a victory tour throughout the cities of Philistia, displaying his power and glory and compelling the people to acknowledge his greatness and his power. And it's especially interesting and important for us to note, I think, that the Lord does so without the help of the Israelites and without hindrance from the Philistines. His power is great, and he does his will. He does whatever he pleases, and he does it wherever he pleases, not just in the land of Israel, but in the land of Philistia and anywhere else within his creation. And so to summarize, we can see that the point of this story, once again, is that it makes clear in many different ways that the Lord alone is God. He alone has power and glory. And all of the so-called gods of human imagining are powerless to save, powerless to bless, powerless to give the good and abundant life that they promise. Now, I want to bring this to a close by taking a little bit of time to ask three practical questions by way of application. And the first question actually comes from you kids. So I understand that a few weeks ago, you read through this story in your kids' life classes. And some of your parents told me that some of you were asking this question: why did people worship these silly gods? That is a great question. And the answer is that they were told that if they worshiped these gods, if they made sacrifices to them, these gods would give them things that they wanted really, really badly. Right? So as we've seen, Dagon was the god of the harvest, and he promised that if they worshiped and served him, he would give them great crops so that they would have food to eat. And Baal was the god of the storm. He promised that if you worshiped and made sacrifices to him, he would send rain so that your crops would grow and there'd be a good harvest. And Asherah, she was a goddess who promised that if you worshiped and served her, she'd give you lots of children, so that you could farm your land and, and be more secure financially. And of course, all of these gods promised in one way or another that they would protect you from enemies and other nations who might want to harm you. And so you see, basically, the people worship these gods because these gods promised them that they would save them from the things that threaten them. They promised them that they would bless them and give them a good life. But as we've already seen, these gods can't keep their promises, can they? Because they're not real. They're made up in the minds of men and women. Now, before we think that ancient people were really silly to worship these gods, we need to remember that, in fact, we are every bit as prone as ancient people to worship false gods. It's just that our idols are a little more subtle and a little more sophisticated than theirs. We think, if only I have enough money, or if I had nicer things, then I would be really blessed. I would be really well off. If only I was friends with the really popular kids at school. If only I was a little bit prettier. If only I was a little bit taller. If only I was a little bit thinner. Then I would be well off. Then I would be blessed, and I would have a good life. Right? If only I was respected by my coworkers, and I was regarded as someone who was really successful in my field. If only I had a romantic relationship with that one special person, then I would be blessed and my life would be great. And the thing is, most of these things aren't bad things, are they? But we make them gods, we make them idols when we love them more than we love the Lord, and we look to them for life. We think that having them will give us life more than trusting in the Lord and living in relationship with Him. The second question, how do you know if you're worshiping a false god? How do you know if you've made an idol out of one of these otherwise good things? Well, I think there's maybe three things we could say in answer to that. One clue that you may be worshiping a false god or making an idol out of some otherwise good thing is that you spend an inordinate amount of time thinking about it. Right? That you're almost obsessed with it. It's always on your mind. You're always worrying about it and thinking about it and wondering, how do I get more of this? A second clue that you may be making an idol out of some good thing is that the thought of losing that thing or not obtaining it causes great physical and emotional distress. Many years ago, when I was in seminary, they announced that a pastor was retiring and that this pastor had a massive library of biblical and theological books. And there was going to be the apocalyptic book sale to end all book sales on campus the next day at 1 p.m. in the campus bookstore. Well, if you know anything about seminary, that's like throwing raw meat into a tank of piranhas, right? I mean, it was like there was this furor on campus. All of these amazing books are going to be for sale. And so I made sure that I was at the bookstore door 30 minutes before the doors opened the next day, only to discover to my dismay that there were actually 6 people who were there already who worshiped books more than I did. And as I sat there in line, I began to think about, okay, I've got to figure out my strategy. Do I want to go to the commentary section first? Or maybe I should go to the systematic theological section. Or maybe I need to get some more books on church history. I don't have many books on church history. And then I started to worry, like, but what if the people in front of me, they go to the section where the books I really want are at, and I don't get the books that I just really desperately want to have? And as I began to think about this more and more, I noticed that my heart began to race. And my hands were actually starting to get shaky and sweaty, and I began to feel a little bit nauseous in my stomach. And it was about this point that something deep inside of me, I think we call it the Holy Spirit, said, "What in the world is going on with you, Adam? You are physically affected by your fear that you might not get some of these dumb books." I reflected on it, I realized that what the books promised to give me was intelligence. Well, at least the appearance of intelligence, right? And I had already learned my few years in the world of Reformed and Presbyterian churches that intelligence is a powerful commodity among pastors. And I wanted to be viewed as an intelligent theological pastor. And in my heart, I'd persuaded myself that if I can be really intelligent, or at least viewed as being really intelligent, then I will be blessed. I'll be successful. I'll have meaning and purpose in life. Of course, the end of the story is wonderful. The doors open, we all go in, and it turns out that they had had a secret sale the night before for all the faculty and staff at the seminary, and everything had been totally picked over. The gods fall down, indeed. So this is a second way you can tell you may have made an idol out of some good thing, is that you're physically distressed over the thought of not being able to have that thing. And then the third thing, the third clue that you may have made an idol out of some good thing, is that in your quest to obtain it, you're willing to do things that you know are not pleasing to the Lord or are not consistent with who you are as a follower of Christ. My senior year of high school, I was in a relationship with a young woman that was not good for either one of us. But in junior high, I was overweight, and the girls made fun of me. And so I was just so convinced that if I could just be in a romantic relationship, then, you know, that'll mean my life has meaning. And so I persisted in this relationship for 2 years, even though the whole time God was convicting me that this wasn't a good relationship for me as a follower of Christ. But it took me 2 years to come to terms with the fact that I trusted in having a romantic relationship to give me life more than I trusted in God, who is the fountain of life, as the scriptures say over and over again. And so maybe we should just pause for just a moment right here near the very end of the sermon and ask, is there something in your life that you've made an idol? Something that you love more than you love the Lord? Something that you've set your desires on more than a relationship with the Lord? Something that you think more strongly will give you life if you have it than knowing and walking with the Lord? Last question. Who can save us from our idolatry and actually give us the good and abundant life? The Protestant reformer John Calvin is famous for saying that the fallen human mind is a factory of idols. Right? We seem to have this endless propensity for making idols out of otherwise good things, for setting our affection on them, for craving them, and doing everything we can to obtain them and loving them more than we love the Lord. Right? Who can deliver us from that? Well, as we've seen in our passage, the Lord alone has power to save. And the greatest display of his power is not the fact that he caused the silly god Dagon to fall down in the temple, or even that he afflicted the Philistines with tumors and a plague of mice, nor even the great plagues that he sent upon the Egyptians during the Exodus. The greatest display of the Lord's power is that he sent his Son. It's the life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus. That's where we see the Lord is able to save. That's where we see the Lord is able to bless and give the abundant life that he promises now and in the age to come. And through faith in Jesus, you can be completely forgiven. I can be completely forgiven for all of our silly idolatry, the way in which we repeatedly set our hearts on and worship gods that just in the end fall down. And not only that, by the Spirit that Jesus gives, our hearts are renewed so that more and more we trust in the Lord and His love and His power, His ability to save, His ability to give life. Amen.
This has been a ministry of City Life Church in St. Paul, Minnesota. We hope you were encouraged by this teaching. Thank you for listening, and please contact us at info@citylifetc.org if we can be of service to you. Peace be with you.